Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Ask Me Anything episode. It is Friday, and for something different, I'm actually doing this sitting on some grass on the Gold Coast a few days before I go home to Paris. And I'm sitting here with Liana, who many of you, some of you, particularly those of you who subscribe to my Substack, would know Liana. She is the person that answers the emails, does all the work behind the scenes, is my second brain, finishes my sentences for me. And she's sitting here with me. We've been working together. By the way, why don't you say hello?
Hi, everyone.
Everyone meet Liana. How long have we been working with each other for? That's the part of the brain that you control, answering things that are to do with years.
2021, COVID.
Yeah.
I was in Melbourne, lockdown.
So we didn't get to meet in that period. And then then you came to Queensland, and then there was a lockdown here and we didn't get to meet. And then we finally met when I came to the Writers' Festival in Byron Bay. We worked out a bit over 2 years. Yeah, almost 2 years ago, is it? No.
2022. So, yeah, almost 2 years ago.
And so this is the second time we've met. So, as always, if you are listening to this on Apple or Spotify, hello, you will only get the audio version of this. If you are watching this on Substack, well, if you're listening to this on Apple or Spotify, you can come and watch this on Substack. We make this available to the subscribers where you get to see a visual of me and Liana doing our thing. So we're sitting on park, got the ocean in the background. There we go. There it is. Construction workers walking by. It's a little bit windy, so we're a bit concerned about the sound. But yes, you can become a subscriber at sarahwilson.substack.com, and there you can join the comments threads. I join it. Maybe you'll join it this time too, Liana. And we have a very robust conversation each week. It's a beautiful community. And of course, I'm on my way. By the time you listen to this, I will have completed my last in real life Substack meetup, which is in Byron Bay this evening. This comes out on the Friday. We're recording this on Thursday afternoon. So there's some of the benefits. There's a bunch of other benefits, aren't there? I give bonus episodes. I do extra posts, more intimate posts, and there's a really lovely community who meet up and do book club stuff, and it's very, very supportive. So speaking of which, the questions for the AMA come from the Substack community. So there's a post thread at the top of the homepage where you can post your question. And we've gone through, and Liana, you've selected a bunch of questions that you are going to read out on behalf of people who have asked these questions. So hit me with it. I'm going to answer them without thinking about them, looking at them too much.
This one's from Rebecca. I was wondering whether the Sarah of today has the same commitment to others eating a no low sugar diet. Some of the language in your I Quit Sugar books makes me uncomfortable, especially with what we now know about diet culture and the labeling of different foods as good or bad, poison, toxic. Full disclosure, I'm struggling to recover from an eating disorder, amongst other things, and so my vision may be unfairly coloured on this topic.
All right. It's Rebecca, is it?
It's Rebecca.
So, Rebecca, I should also point out that Rebecca also heavily caveated her question with lots of, I don't want to be calling you out on anything. I don't ask this to be nasty. I'm genuinely curious. And I do take your question in that spirit, Rebecca. So I don't waver on what I wrote about nor the language that I used back then. As I wrote the book, and Liana, you, I think, first came across me through that No Yes. Sugar stuff many, many years ago, I was very careful with my language. And I should say I used to update the science on a regular basis, and I would do a full disclosure on it where either the science changed or if I'd got the science wrong for some reason, I would let everybody know about it. But in terms of the tone, and I think that's what you're referring to there, I still stand by it. The book was called I Quit Sugar, not You Must Quit Sugar. And I was always using sort of phrases like, this is a gentle invitation. And here's some information that you might like to know about. And this is how you can go about shifting things if this is stuff that interests you. And so I did use language like a toxin, because I do think sugar is a toxin. That's not to say that the food that it's contained in is a toxin. We've just got to be aware that it's the quantity. Always it's about the quantity and the way in which we eat sugar in our culture. Not the sugar that we were eating, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago, or even 100 years ago. It's the way, and it is toxic. And our body processes sugar as it processes toxins like alcohol and drugs and so on through the liver rather than through our cells. So I think all of that is true. I was very mindful of people with eating disorders. You know, I've been open about the fact that I had bulimia when I was a teenager. People close to me have had eating disorders. I am very aware of the mindset. But I also think that it helps to have the information and then to have it presented in a forum, a context, which I think the I Quit Sugar community was, where we normalized discussions around it, but we also normalized abundant eating. So it wasn't about, I really tried to take it away from that punishing mindset of restriction. And so one of the big phrases from memory, I'm casting my mind back, was crowding out. So rather than going, do not do this, and I had this phrase, when we see a wet paint sign, it says, do not touch, all we want to do as humans is touch it. That's what we do. And that's why diets don't work. So I would not use that kind of language. I'd instead say, well, I'd focus on the abundance that you could eat. And I didn't restrict alcohol. The program included a glass of red wine, I think 5 or 6 nights a week. I didn't dark chocolate, and also there was no calorie counting, very little discussion of weight. And in fact, we used to do these sort of, data collection where we'd see people's reasons for entering the program. And if they hadn't been part of the community, it was because of weight loss. But within about a couple of weeks of doing the program, their motivations, their reasoning for wanting to continue was to do around mood and energy levels. And I think that speaks to what was emphasized on the program itself. So, yeah, that's where I'm at. I think that when we have conditions and disorders and that are a result of cultural practices, norms and pressures and wrongnesses. Yes, we have to be sensitive, but I also think we're only going to get over them. We're only going to be able to move forward if we accept what is actually happening and we look at it squarely and then we get help in making better decisions. So, yeah, I hope that answers the question.
This one's come from Natty. How did or do you deal with heartbreak, Sarah? I mean, in a romantic sense. Have you had any experience that you struggled to overcome and time and space haven't really helped as people say they do? What's your take on this topic? Obviously, it's something relevant to me at the moment and would love to hear your perspective.
Yeah, I saw this question come in, I think this morning, and so I sort of added it to the list and I haven't had a chance to think about my answer, but I am very prone to heartbreak. I've had, well, partly because I've been single for such a long time and I'm a hopeful romantic, so I've gone to that place probably more times than the average woman has. In an era where there's a lot of love bombing and then dropping a woman from a great height via ghosting and other bad practices, which are not serving humanity in any shape or form. So, yes, I'm very familiar with heartbreak and I go hard. I go hard. Liana's, you've witnessed it.
Yeah.
But Liana's fairly privy to my various heartbreaks that I've had over the last couple of years. So I don't think it's avoidable. But what I take your question to be really asking is, what is the mindset? What is the coping mechanism? What is the emotional landing place that can make sense when you have to go through it? And I think I've got a good answer for that, and I have to defer to the wonderful poet David White. Years ago, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I remember him talking about heartbreak, and he basically said that heartbreak is when you've got to say goodbye to something or someone before you're ready to, when you've got to let go of, let's say, the hope of a romantic relationship before you're ready to do it. And it's so hard. I don't think there's anything quite like it, because it brings up every other heartbreak that you've ever had, romantic or otherwise. That sense of having to cope with a thing that was that you'd cleaved to and that is no longer. And then there's the rejection, and then there's the self-sabotaging and all of this kind of thing. And then there's the sociological discussions that we have around it all, because it is really hard to fathom what's going on more broadly, because we're seeing a lot more heartbreak happening at a time when we really don't need more heartbreak. We need to be giving each other a lot more heart embracement. So, this idea that David White talks about is that we will be heartbroken often. It is an inevitability of life. And what we can do is sometimes feel that we should have protected ourselves from it. We should have withdrawn earlier. And he says, absolutely not, because you're going to be heartbroken no matter what. If it's not today, it's some other day. And so love recklessly, love fully, love bravely, love courageously, go there, and accept that at some point you will be heartbroken, but at least you'll have had the love, and you would have had the experience of the courage, and you would have had the experience of living life fully as well as the heartbreak, if that makes sense. In his book Consolations, he also has a rundown about heartbreak. He's also written a book about it, and I'll put the links on the Substack so that you can all read it. From memory, it's to the effect of how heartbreak isn't an inevitability. It's a necessary part of life, and it's actually a part of life that takes us to a more mature version of ourselves and a deeper version of ourselves, and therefore he invites us to embrace it and actually to see it as a sort of an apprenticeship, you know, in our humanity. So in terms of what was the name of the person who sent this? Natty, in terms of having a landing place, a beautiful landing place for whatever heartbreak you're feeling at the moment, sort of a God's eye view of things, a view that makes you go, well, that enables you to see your future self having learned whatever lesson is to be learned, because you want to know that there's going to be a lesson to be learned from it now. You want to be sort of guaranteed of that to give context to the pain that you're feeling right at this time. Then I would say that the God's eye view affords that. And the God's eye view is really, I think, that it does take us to some depths of courage, compassion, of love, of our mature selves that maybe we wouldn't get in any other format. So I feel, I have to remind myself of this. I know the painful spot you're in, and I think you know this, Natty. I think everybody listening knows this. It's for a reason, and it makes sense. And if life was easy and if we didn't have these heartbreaks, we'd be pretty bland, vanilla, unexciting people who aren't going to be the people that others want sitting next to them at the dinner party, you know? I hope that helps.
A family member has been diagnosed with bipolar. They have been whipping up a frenzy between family members for many years, choosing enemies and making up stories about them to rally the troops, being physically and verbally abusive. When we get to a point of enough to save ourselves, the temporary calm ensures the disorder blamed.
So the temporary calm comes, and then the blame on the disorder follows shortly after.
Correct. I'd love to hear your take on this. Where is the line? Being understanding and supportive, but protecting oneself. It's ultimately bad for this person to be excused from such destructive behavior.
Yeah, I came across this when I was just sort of flicking through, waiting at the cafe for Liana just earlier, and there was a really lovely conversation in the thread from a bunch of people who both have someone in their life who has a mental disorder and knows the scenario that Natasha is in. It's Natasha, isn't it? And also people with a mental disorder who are aware that they have this impact on their own family and friends. And so I encourage you to go and read that part of the AMA threads. As I say, it's at the top of the Substack homepage. I've pinned it up there permanently so that whenever you've got a question that you want to ask for this format, it's right there and you don't have to go hunting for it. So I suppose, Natasha, you're asking me this because I have a diagnosed mental disorder. For those of you who are not familiar with this, I've written about it in First We Make the Beast Beautiful. I was diagnosed with bipolar when I was 21 and OCD when I was sort of a teenager, and then more recently with autism spectrum disorder. And I've written about how I've distanced myself from these diagnoses you know, in my more recent years, in a recent post, which I think Natasha's probably referring to. The question really is, how much leniency do we give to somebody who behaves really badly and hurts the people around them? How much leniency do we give to them? How much do we allow them to blame it on their mental disorder? And it's a hard one because I think poor behaviour is often a reflection of an inability to sit with the incongruencies that you're feeling as a part of your disorder and all of the clusterfuck of stuff that goes with it. Am I hurting other people? Do I have rights to voice what I'm feeling? For women in particular, I think there's a lot of silencing and then sort of blurting out and then a silencing. There's this kind of to and fro, a tug of war. And I think every woman knows that feeling, even if they haven't got a mental disorder. It's this idea of, am I allowed to? And then, yes, I should be able to. And then it comes out distorted and weird and maybe more aggressive and less balanced and less clear. I do find that, so obviously I've met lots of people with bipolar over the years. We tend to find each other late at night wandering the streets. And I tend to find that men with the condition can tend to give themselves a very long leash, and they can tend to just let rip. Women have this default, I think, that still comes into play even when you're at your most pained and despairing and discombobulated, to protect others and to not cause trouble, you know. Even if it comes out a bit weird, there is still that desire. So I think at times men do let it rip, and irresponsibly so, and that might be to do with capacity. Capacity and the learnings, the difference in the way that men and women learn to manage and take responsibility for their emotions more broadly. So was it a male relative? I get the sense that it was
it
for some reason.
Like, yeah,
there might have been a he in there. So that's a couple of things. I think there is a distinction. I think that these kinds of outbursts can sometimes really be reflective of the pain. And quite often in those moments, I know I respond really well to being told, it's okay, I love you. It's okay, you're going through this. Like, just, we can hold it. Let's just kind of, you know, sit through it, and we'll all be good. To be told that it's okay can actually get me to calm down. It gets rid of a layer of dissonance. And so I can piece apart a few of the thoughts that are racing through my mind at the time. The other thing I think is, speaking to the male-female distinction, I think that women will withdraw at times, even though there's a lot of talk about how men with depression withdraw into a cave and don't seek help and so on. I think when you're talking about these kinds of disorders, when it's at an extreme, women do try to protect those around them by disappearing. Certainly what I've done. I take off overseas. I take off in my tent for several days, and I very much try to spare everyone around in my orbit from the worst of it. Now, where do you draw the line? because blaming bad behavior on a mental disorder, I've got to say, I've got a bit of a bias around it, as in I feel, and I'm a little bit of the school of the hard lessons and deal it up brutally. I tend to veer on, you know, towards that end of the pendulum swing because it has worked for me. I do think if you've got a behavioral disorder like bipolar, then, or I should say a psychological disorder, then there is room to be corrected on it. There is room to be sort of ricocheted out of your condition and to do better. And so I think that holding people to account for that kind of behavior is a good thing. That's how I feel. In the end, in the long run, you're doing somebody a favor by calling out that that's a tendency to blame it on, you know, on a disorder. Yeah. Particularly if they calm down and then they do it. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. It's like the abuser, you know, who says, oh, I didn't mean to, and they come after you trying to beg for your forgiveness. And I've actually done a podcast, no, a Substack post on that, how to do a proper apology. And I'll put that in the show notes as well, because it's actually really worth thinking, yeah, having a look at that. It's about how to do a proper apology no matter what it is that you've done. It's by a rabbi. Obviously a Jewish rabbi living in New York. So I would say that you do need to find a way to call them out. I think in the moment when they're behaving badly, you can say to them, hey, listen, I love you, but this is my boundary. I think you can feel safe with that. And then when they've calmed down and they're out of the cycle, have a really good discussion with them about all of this. You're probably doing them a favor. What I would say is that a personality disorder, so when you're talking about some of those more extreme, like borderline personality disorder and so on, it is a little bit different, because the evidence suggests that with a personality disorder, there is not the same capacity for the person to be aware of what they're doing and to even care. But with somebody with a psychological disorder, you can talk with them. In fact, mostly they're wanting to improve. We've got to hold each other to account, and it is, and I do think there is a movement at the moment to sweeping bad behavior, and also behaviors that need to be looked at in a different way, under the carpet and being slapped with, I'm mixing my metaphors here, but being slapped with a label that says mental disorder, do not come here, do not trigger this person. And that's not going to do anyone any favors. There is that tendency in our culture because we have become so weird around discomfort. We have been so, we've become so weird around people's identities. And Natasha, you'd probably enjoy going back and reading a post I wrote about, well, it's actually the same post, I think, Liana, the one that I wrote about how I don't identify with my diagnoses anymore because of the way that identity politics and the way that these kinds of things have been stigmatized and overemphasized, particularly amongst young people. That was a rambly answer, I think, because I don't quite know where that line lies, but I am probably veering towards going confrontation, and it's just about finding your timing. I think you can do both. I think you can say, hey, I love you and your family, and we are going to be here for you, and this is shit behavior, and it's not good enough to blame it on a disorder. And if you would like us to understand your disorder better, we can have a conversation, and we can also talk about ways of supporting you in these moments, but we need to know that you are going to be able to be held to account on it and be part of this process. And in First We Make the Beast Beautiful, I have a couple of chapters where I do give advice for the loved ones of people with mental health conditions and what they can do in those really tricky moments. Okay, I think we're out of time. Everyone, please thank Liana. She is seriously the greatest, well, friend and chunk of my brain that can finish questions and read my garbled emails and deal with my impatience and
it's a pleasure.
She says through a fixed smile. For everyone listening on Apple and Spotify, a reminder, you can join the community at any time over at Substack, sarahwilson.substack.com. It's about 1,700 subscribers there now, and it's a wonderful community. You can also be a free subscriber. That's 53,000 free subscribers who partake in the conversation once a week on sort of a post on a Wednesday as well. Post your questions. I will be getting through a few of them at a time, but I will be answering them from Paris from next week. It's lovely to have the sunshine in the background. It's very fitting for my last AMA in Australia. All right. See you later.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.